So this morning I want to introduce to you or talk to you about a key Buddhist concept called skillful or skillfulness, the idea of skillfulness. And this is very key in Buddhism because decisions about what to do, choices we make, in classic Buddhism goes back to the question, is it skillful or not? What is skillful or not? The Buddha, when people went to the Buddha a few times, said, when I visit a teacher, what should I ask that teacher? Good question, right? And the Buddha said, you should ask about what is skillful. So it's a very key concept. When I was in Japan in the mid-80s, I met a lovely, wonderful woman, American, who'd lived there for many years by that time. I don't know how many years, 10, 20 years, studying Zen. And she had been studying with one of the more renowned Rinzai Zen masters in Japan, and who had a monastery for monks. And so she was able to go study with him every day, and she was able to do retreats there, sesshins there. But because she was a woman, she couldn't actually live there and live in the monastic, you know, monastic compound. And so the abbot was concerned about her training, her Zen training, that it was not complete. She was getting the meditation training and the training that happens in the interviews with the teacher. But the kind of the training, other kinds of training she wasn't getting because she wasn't living the monastic life with everyone. So he wanted to figure out or offer her an alternative to living in the monastery that could provide her the same training that the monks were getting in the monastery. So he set her up to go study with one of the great pottery masters in nearby. And so she went and did pottery. She didn't know anything about pottery, I guess, before she started, and she started learning how to throw pots and do everything. And the Zen master, he saw that the training of pottery making was equivalent to this intensive monastic training that his monks were getting in the monastery. So that's an interesting comparison. What is it that makes it comparable? And I think one of the things that's comparable about it is that both of them entail developing of skill, developing a certain kind of presence of being and way of engaging with your activity, what you're doing, that is very engaged, very present, but also very skillful. You develop a skill to put you right into the present and to be efficient, to have some mastery over something. And what you learn when you develop mastery over something is very helpful for developing mastery over meditation, mastery over Buddhist spiritual life. A lot of the same skills, a lot of the same capacities and abilities that are needed for mastering pottery or music, playing or just about anything at all, any craft, is also needed for meditation practice. There's a very famous quote in the Dhammapada where the Buddha summarizes the teachings of the Buddhas, not only himself, but all Buddhas, in three lines, in three little phrases. He says, to not do evil, to avoid doing evil, to engage in what is skillful, to purify the mind, this is the teachings of the Buddha. So you have these three parts. So, and this is also often translated in English and differently because the word skillful is kind of clumsy. you know, it's what it means. It's not obvious right off the bat what it means. It's not poetic or... So it's very common to translate this in English to avoid evil, do good, purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. But when you say good, good is so vague. It kind of maybe feels good. It kind of has, you know, resonates in some kind of vague way. Everyone knows what good is in their own language. But good doesn't really, you know, people have different opinions. What does good mean? Why is it? And when you say translated as good, you don't quite get the meaning of skillful. Cultivate what's skillful. Another translation for this word, kusala, Pali word kusala, it's very common also in English, is wholesome. And it's certainly an improvement to good. Avoid what's evil. Cultivate what's wholesome. Purify the mind. This is the teachings of the Buddha. And but wholesome has a different connotations, associations in the word skillful as well. wholesome, I think, of it's also it's a kind of a moral value unto wholesome, a little bit. Wholesome means it's holistic, I guess. It's whole. It feels, has a kind of goodness in it. But it's kind of a state. It's kind of like a wholesome, has, in my mind, has a suggestion of something that's wholesome in and of itself. Whereas skillful has the idea that it's for a purpose. It's forward leading. You know, you develop a skill in order to do something. You're skillful in order to develop something, master something. And so the word kusala means skill. And so a very big part of what the Buddha was trying to teach was cultivation, development of skillful qualities, skillful things. And primarily when the Buddha talked about skill, he talked about skillful qualities of mind. Developing your mind so it has still skillful qualities, skillful characteristics, still skillful capacities, skillful ways of engaging. Now, you know, skillfulness, I suppose, means things like mastery, proficiency, efficiency. It means you can do something, you develop something. It also speaks to that side of humanity where we can develop ourselves. Rather than taking who we are as a given and just accepting what we are and saying, well, you know, this is how things are and I'll just have to live this way and just accept it or somehow leave it at that, then, you know, then if we do that, then we're just kind of just a sense of victims of what's already happened to us. But because we have the capacity to develop ourselves, we don't have to be the victims of what's already happened. We can cultivate and grow and develop. There are people who engage spirituality, Buddhist spirituality, as an issue of knowledge. That's a matter of understanding something. And so people pore over Buddhist books, endless Buddhist books. They'll get PhDs in Buddhism as a way of trying to get the right understanding. If they have the right understanding, boom, then everything will be okay. Because, you know, then, you know. And sometimes it happens in small steps. People, you'll hear a teacher say something or you read something in a book and it shifts your perspective on something. And there's a new understanding that can make a big, big difference. And so we can have, you know, a different relationship through our life. But ultimately, if we're only relying on perspective and knowledge, understanding, then we're not really developing ourselves. And so then we are not really able to meet all the challenges life might bring us in different situations. If we develop a skill, develop a skillfulness, develop our skills, then those skills are portable. And we take them with us wherever we go, and we can use them in different situations. In addition, separate from the idea of knowledge, there are some Buddhist practitioners who are experience junkies. They think the whole point of Buddhism is to have a particular experience. And they go on retreats, and they want to have a really good experience on the retreat. And or they come back and they want their experience to be the validation of the retreat experience, of how what good it did for them. And in a sense, experience is not that important in Buddhism as people would think, because people think, oh, meditation, that's about having particular experience. And we're looking for that right experience. Experience is not as important in Buddhism as, again, developing skill, developing an ability, strengthening an ability. You know, going to the gym might be a good experience, but we don't go to the gym to have a good experience. We go to the gym to develop ourselves, to get strong. And if you have an injury, for example, then it's good to go to the gym and develop some strength around the muscles maybe that are weak. And so, you know, so you develop that capacity that you know you have. In a sense, this is pointing towards the good news of Buddhism, which is that part of the good news is that we're able to develop ourselves, we're able to develop skill. The unfortunate thing about developing skill in some people's minds is that develop many skills takes repetition. And repetition takes time. And time, spending a lot of time in developing a skill, is inefficient. And things that are inefficient are not very popular in a culture where getting things fast and quick is really important. And I think meditation practice in this sense, is one of the most inefficient things you can do. And because it takes a lot of repetition. It takes a lot of kind of growth. And some people, of course, are, you know, can settle into meditation very quickly if it's somewhat easy for them. Some people it takes a lot longer. But sometimes it's the people for whom it takes a long time to be able to settle into good meditation practice. It's actually more productive for them. Because again, the point is not to have an experience. The point is to develop oneself, to develop skills. And if it takes a long time to develop, to figure out how to settle in meditation, it means that you're kind of learning about yourself, learning a lot about yourself, learning how your mind works, how your body works, how your relationship to things is, how to activate certain qualities, how to let go of other qualities that are overactive. And so you have to learn a lot about yourself in the process of learning meditation, develop a lot of skill. Someone who's kind of living a very calm life, you know, has some natural ability to get concentrated, and they sit down to meditate, and boom, they get deep peace. That's nice for them. But it might not help them when there's some big crisis in their life, because they haven't learned anything about themselves. They just kind of dropped into some deep place. So to develop skill takes repetition. And in this regard, it's interesting that the word skill, in Indo-European, in its kind of linguistic origins, Indo-European origins, the word skill means to separate. And actually, I believe it's the same thing in Norwegian. They use the word skille. Skille is almost like skill, right? And it means to separate. So probably it's connected also. And and then to separate then came down further down into the Indo-European kind of tree down towards us. It became to differentiate, to make distinctions. And then we have skill. So there's something in the at least in linguistic root of the word skill that involves making differences, making distinctions. And that's part of what happens with training. If you repeat repetitive training, if you repeat something over and over and over again, you're able to make more and more refined distinctions. You're able to make more and more refined differentiations. So you can make slight adjustments or appropriate adjustments for developing that skill. So, you know, if you want to master swimming, for example, at first you just kind of flop around. I'm teaching my 4-year-old how to swim right now. And, you know, there's a lot of distinctions he's going to have to learn. Right now, I can get him to kind of kick his legs and to paddle one hand, but he holds onto my other hand, which is pretty good. And right now, I'm trying to work on him flattening out his hands and having his fingers kind of more or less together, flat. Because if you have you're holding your hands kind of like a claw when you're swimming, it doesn't quite as efficient, right? So that's a little distinction he has to learn between a claw hand and a flat hand. And and then as you learn to swim and get better and better, if you learn to make more and more finer distinctions between how you move your arm through the water. And even someone who's a great swimmer is still getting more and more, has more and more finesse, more and more subtlety about the distinction they're making or to master the skill of swimming. So to develop a skill, we do through a lot of repetition. And as we develop the repetition, we get familiar with the activity. As we get more and more familiar with the activity, we're able to understand it more and better and better and make finer and finer distinctions. As we make finer and finer distinctions, we can choose those parts of the distinction that are more and more in our favor for the purposes we have. And some of this happens without even thinking about it. In many, many activities, we just do repetition over and over and over again. The subconscious mind, something, does a lot of this work for us. It's not like we have to think so carefully about it all. As it was a story I tell of trying to teach my other son when he was 5, I guess, how to catch a baseball. And I'm not a mean guy, usually, especially with my sons playing catch. But, you know, I would try to explain to him that, you know, he was catching it with his palm, with his glove pointing down all the time. And it's okay, but you can't catch balls, you know, higher than your chest or something then. So I wanted to teach him, you turn the glove around for catching a little higher ball. So I just explained that to him, and he started crying. The poor, you know. And I said, uh-oh. You know, I don't think I was so heavy. I was just kind of just turn the glove up. So I guess I can't tell him how to, you know, I better not tell him anything. I better not explain to him anything about how to catch. I'll just play catch with him. And I played catch and catch and catch. And my wife says, I've become a much better... You know, I can throw the ball a lot better than I could. But slowly, slowly, imperceptibly, you know, he became better and better. And he's, you know, within a year or so, he was kind of an, you know, for his age group, you know, he's an ace baseball catcher. Phenomenal what he can do. Beautiful, elegant, graceful. So the same thing with meditation then. Meditation is a repetitive act. We do it over and over again. And you do it day in, day out. And it's really a great advantage to do it day in, day out without any exception. Because then you start learning the terrain really well. And the idea is to study the terrain, to understand what's going on when you meditate. What is your mind like? What's your attitude like? What are the different capacities of your mind that are active and not active? What's going on with your mood, your emotional state? What's going on with your body, with your energy level? There's so many different distinctions that you can make as you meditate. And some of these, again, don't have to be done so consciously. They kind of come along, just like my son didn't consciously learn how to catch the baseball. It just kind of happens, you know, increment by increment. Some of this can happen incrementally. Just keep meditating over and over and over again. Develop the skill of meditation. But the skill set you need grows faster if you pay attention to what you're doing when you meditate. If you pay attention to what's going on with you. So the insight practice is very important. You understand your condition, what are the different aspects of your condition when you sit down to meditate, and how should you meditate given the conditions you have. You sit down to meditate and you're tired. After meditating for a few months or years or something, you realize that when you're tired, it's really important to sit up straighter. And so you sit up with a little more energy. Oomph. So you kind of overcome that sleepiness a little bit. Or you say that you're really aching a lot, somehow emotionally or physically, and you find out that maybe a certain way of meditating helps you stay present, because the ache tends to trip you up and you tend to wander off into thought a lot. So you find that if I put a lot of emphasis on paying attention to my body, much more on my body than on the breath, then I can stay present, because otherwise my mind will drift off. Or you learn that there's a lot of strong emotions going on. You learn that maybe if you're agitated, maybe it's really good to sometimes count your breath. So these are kind of gross distinctions, but you can learn. But as you do learn meditation, you learn more and more of this stuff. And you learn how to, the skill set needed in order to be able to settle into meditation in a deeper way. So then this famous saying of the Buddha, avoid what's evil, cultivate what's skillful, and purify the mind. These are the teachings of the Buddha. The third line is purify the mind. And this is shorthand for liberation, for the kind of purification of what the fetters, the defilements, the torments, the different kind of ways in which the mind is attached, the Velcro of the mind, the way in the mind is obsessed, caught, afraid, hateful, all the ways in which the mind is not free. So to purify the mind is to purify it of the bonds, the bondage that keeps the mind, the heart, unfree. So the mind, the heart is free. And so we can ask, so that's the ultimate goal. Then the skillfulness of Buddhism is what is it, skillfulness has a purpose, has a direction. You don't want to just develop a skill for its own sake. So what is that purpose? And the Buddhism is to purify the mind. And so to liberate the mind. So what is it that's skillful to do for that purpose? So rather than saying what's wholesome or what's good, which is rather vague, you can ask, what is it that's skillful? What is it? Or I like to translate this word kusala sometimes as helpful. Rather than translating as even skillful, I like helpful. What is helpful and what is not helpful? To maybe be able to make that distinction. Remember, distinctions here are important, right? So what is helpful and what is not helpful? It's a very simple binary question. Some people would say it's dualistic. Dualism gets a really bad rap in some spiritual circles. So I try not to use the word because I'd just be hounded out of town. So I use the word binary. And here in Silicon Valley, there's a really important binary thing going on. It's like the whole economy is based on binary. A non-dual economy in Silicon Valley wouldn't work. So this is a simple question. Is it helpful or is it not? And so what is helpful for you when you sit down to meditate? What is helpful? So, for example, it's helpful to meditate every day. Over the long term, it's helpful. In the short term, you might say, well, in the short term, I don't think it's so helpful for me to meditate today because I have a lot to do. Or I feel kind of lousy. And it's not going to make me feel any better. I'll just sit there with my lousiness. And that's not any good. But in the long term, it's actually helpful to sit with your lousiness because then you'll learn about what your lousiness is like. You don't distract yourself from it. You don't try to fix it in some magical thinking. You learn what's really going on there and you learn to settle yourself in the lousiness. And so over the long term, you get more and more familiar with yourself and you learn yourself. So you learn it's skillful to not meditate every day. It's skillful to study yourself, to get to know yourself better. I've known Buddhist meditators who have done Buddhism as a kind of magical thinking. They just sit, do their duty, sit in the cushion, and somehow be present. That somehow, they'll be rewarded. Probably heard plenty of times the famous quote of Ajahn Sumedho. If enlightenment came from sitting, chickens would be enlightened. And so sitting by itself, just sitting there and, is not the point. The point is to sit and then you study. What is this going on here? You inquire. What is this? What is this? What's going on here? What's happening here? So that's part of the skillfulness, is the ability to question, to look, to investigate. And the ability to investigate is a skill that gets developed over time. You learn how to do it over time, better and better. And then you learn, what is useful to pay attention to. Once you kind of better sense of the terrain of where you're at, you get more skill. Okay, now that I know what's happening, where should I pay attention? So, for example, as you sit down to meditate, you might realize that the mind is drifting off in thought a lot. The mind drifting off in thought a lot is an indication that the mind is interested in something. The mind doesn't drift off unless it has some interest. And then you can ask the question, or investigate, why is this so interesting? Or is this really the most interesting thing for me? Is this the most valuable thing for me to do, is to go off drifting off in thought? Or is there something much more interesting here, more valuable for me? And unless you have some sense that being present here and now, being connected to your breath, your body, here and now, is more interesting than your discursive wanderings of thought, why would you want to be present? But if you know that it's more interesting here, then you have much better chance of reining in that distracting mind and come in and show up and be here. So sometimes it's useful to just do that, discursive analysis. What am I interested in right now? How interested am I in anything, in my breath, my meditation? To be honest, I'm not that interested at all. But can I make myself more interested? What's interesting about this? And one of the things that I do for this is that a very simple analysis distinction. When I'm in my drifting away in thought, it's not an embodied experience. I'm not connected to an embodied, real sense of life, lived life. I'm often kind of a virtual world. If I come back into my body as I meditate, I feel an embodied sense of presence. Substantial sense or vital sense of being in my body. And I find this very satisfying, even when my body aches. And that distinction between a disembodied kind of sensibility, or kind of disembodied is not the right word, but kind of not connected to my body feeling when my mind wanders off in thought, versus being connected to my body, is such an important distinction for me, and really helps me then to kind of say, oh yeah, this is where I want to be. And I take more interest to this experience here. Coming back and being here. So there's skills to be developed in patience. Developing our patience is probably one of the first skills that meditators need to learn. There's skills in investigation. There's skills in concentration. There's skills in staying non-reactive, staying equanimous to what's going on. There's skills in applying our effort, energy in our practice. Different situations, different amount of energies are needed. So we experiment with different energy levels, different energy applications. There's skills in maybe in confidence. There's skillfulness in joy. Joy doesn't have to be something just this, you know, comes on its own. But there's this kind of skill in being able to cultivate, to arouse joy and feel joy as we sit and meditate, to evoke it. There's skill in tranquility, being calm. And all these skills that we learn are then translatable or usable in other circumstances of our life. If we learn that in meditation practice, then in other situations out in about town, going about, with our trying and difficult situations, you'll have the capacity to investigate, to stay calm, to be concentrated, to be patient, to be non-reactive, to be equanimous, to be tranquil. Because you've cultivated that ability. Not because you carry it with you, not because you carry your calm everywhere you go, but because you've learned that calm is a skill that you learn you can cultivate, you can evoke, you can call forth, you can kind of bring about calm. You can help yourself become calmer, as people do. You know, if people get really angry, sometimes we'll walk away from the confrontation, breathe, count to 10, and then come back to talk to the person because they calm themselves down a little bit. So we can have the skill to engage a change, to change us in some way, so that how we are is more skillful and more useful for the situation we're in. Now, one of the beautiful things about cultivating a skill, thinking about that as a kind of part of one aspect of Buddhist practice, is that a skill is developed in a circumstances, in an activity where you fail in the activity, right? So say you said you're going to do something, and say you decide you're going to walk from here to San Francisco because you want to develop stronger legs, and you only get to San Bruno. You failed in your task. You could go home miserable. I failed. However, San Bruno is a long way to walk to. You know, it's not as far as San Francisco. And you've developed your strength a little bit in the distance you've walked. So you failed in what you tried to do, but you still had the benefit of developing this strength as you're trying to do it. So if we're looking, from a spiritual point of view, if we're looking at skillfulness, developing skills as one of the things we're doing, then it frees us up a little bit from being preoccupied or only measuring our activities, whether activities are successful or not. So if your meditation one morning is a total failure, I don't know what criteria you'd use for that, but say you fail totally, it might actually have been a very good meditation from the point of view of developing skill. Maybe you measured failure by being completely restless. But because you were so restless, you had to actually evoke a lot of inner strength to stay rooted on your cushion, because most of your muscles were ready to bolt. Mm-hmm. And so the strength of determination was developed because you were determined. I said I was going to sit for 30 minutes. I'm going to sit here. And so a sense of resolve got stronger. And that's a skill, a sense of resolve and determination that got strengthened by hanging in there to doing what we said we were going to do. So even though we didn't settle the restlessness, a skill is still developed. And because skills are portable, because skills can be taken with us in different circumstances, then the hope in Buddhism is that you develop a kind of skillful mind, a skillful ability, so that in situations that are challenging to you, or not challenging, you have the ability to stay free in the middle of those circumstances. So that you come to some situation where someone's angry with you, or in all kinds of terrible things, or you get sick, or you're suddenly in the hospital emergency, and you say, look, I have the skills now. I can evoke these skills. I don't have to be the passive kind of you need to be passive, you know, you not take care of myself. So like Mary Orr, who's a Vipassana teacher in Santa Cruz, she was in a car accident a couple of weeks ago. And they had to kind of helicopter out to the hospital. And she turned out to be fine in the end, but they didn't know that for a while. And so they helicoptered her to San Jose Trauma Center. And the reason she knows she's fine, she said, I have so many, they did so many CAT scans on me that I can no longer be hypochondriac. You know, they, whatever I thought would ail me before, you know, I had all these suspicions, there's nothing. So she's okay. Those of you who know her, she's okay, but she was in a car accident. You know, it was because she was trapped in her car and they had to kind of come and this, the claw jaw, they could break it open, and it was kind of dramatic. And she claims that it's the fruit of her years of practice that kicked in, that she was able to stay calm and be curious, to have a sense of investigation. What's going on here? What's happening with her mind? What's happening in the situation? It was the fruit of her years of practice. And I've heard other people make similar claims, that it's the fruit of the years of practice that will come into play in times of crisis. And if you have that ability to develop a skill, then you don't have to ask someone else for help. And there's nothing wrong with asking people for help. But, you know, sometimes people evoke unseen forces for help when maybe, you know, they didn't have to, if they... and then finally, this thing about skill, as we make finer and finer distinctions, have the ability to kind of monitor ourselves in more and more refined ways, then we learn how to settle and quiet down all the agitation, all the greediness, all the obsessiveness of the mind, all the clingings in the mind, more and more get settled, quiet down. And as we continue this skillfulness in looking and seeing and studying, being present, then more and more subtle degrees of clinging begin to evaporate, begin to dissolve. And subtle does not mean insignificant. Subtle, the subtle things that are, we've discovered when the mind is quieter and quieter are considered the very roots, the kind of foundation upon which much of our personality or difficulties in life are built. And so as the mind gets, if you have the skill, the ability to settle and quiet and calm the mind more and more, then eventually you can get down to that foundation level. And then by that time you have so much skill that you've developed that you have the skillfulness in how to address this foundational level so that you can somehow, so the foundation can drop, bottom can drop, is one expression they use in Buddhism. Some people have the sense that the bottom just drops away. Some people have the experience that the bottom, the foundation just dissolves. And it can kind of sound kind of frightening, right, to have the foundation disappear under you. But if you think of the foundation as being clinging, then you know, to have the clinging drop away is a good thing. And then your heart can be free. So I hope this made sense. One of the things I wanted to try to convey this morning was the importance of skill, developing skill, skillfulness, how important it is in Buddhism, what an important concept it is. And so when Buddhists will say, you know, what should I do? They'll look often first, what is skillful? What is not skillful? What's a skillful thing to do here? What's a not skillful thing to do? So we have 5 minutes. And now you have a chance to ask questions or clarify or make comments if you'd like. Repeat what the Buddha said about the Buddha's teaching. So it's one of the few places where the Buddha summarized his teachings. He said, to not do evil, to engage in what is skillful, to purify the mind. This is the teachings of the Buddha. Let's see, he has the mic. Len.
The little story you told about your son and learning how to catch. Would you apply that more generally about it? Was that a skillful approach to learning? I mean, I don't mean particularly in his situation, but in general, to reject advice and all the culture of the world's history? And
No. I think that I wouldn't generalize it. You know, for this five-year-old, you know, five-year-olds have complex personalities sometimes they don't have the subtlety or the sophistication to figure out, you know, see there's alternatives or see grays, you know, and see different ways. And, you know, it's just, you know, so you kind of, so for him at that particular time, it didn't work. And my son, he had this problem, it's less now that he's nine, if he couldn't do something perfectly, then why should he learn to do it? And then he was, incapable, or kind of a paradox, right? Anyway, the point was, if he didn't know how to do it right the first time, then he would just be kind of really hard for him. So I don't know where he got that from, born that way. But now he's grown out of it. Now he has more understanding. So there are certainly times with adults, for example, it's better to leave them alone, let them find out for themselves. And sometimes it's really good to teach them. So now my son is nine, and he just finished pitching camp. You know, he's really into baseball, right? So he did this, you know, three times a week last week, camp, where there's this guy who was a professional pitcher for the Florida Marlins, you know, who came and, you know, and showed, you know, he was showing them, he was teaching them. You know, he didn't protest, he was really into it, he was really jazzed. A professional player. He listened raptly. But, you know, I was a father, and I wasn't professional. So sometimes it's useful to teach people things, for sure. But sometimes it's useful to stay out of their way and let people learn on their own. There's something about learning by oneself that's it's sometimes more useful than having someone else teach you. There's something, learning about self-reliance, learning about, we learn how to develop a skill. And so to be told, made things too easy, sometimes we don't develop ourselves in the process. And we don't develop patience, we don't develop some of the inner qualities that are needed. So I know there's some meditation teachers who would be aghast at how much I teach here. See, you know, it's like giving baby food to babies, is what they say sometimes, or something like that. So just a guess. Gil, don't tell them everything. It just doesn't work. You have to just let them learn themselves. You should give these very vague, abstract talks that doesn't really tell them anything. So they're kind of left on their own, and they can kind of have to figure it out on themselves, and they come and talk to you, and if they, you know, got it right, then you kind of just nod approvingly. But I, you know, compared to those teachers, you know, I explain a lot, and so some of you probably don't think I explain enough. But anyway, sorry, is that was a long answer. Is that addressing your question? Okay, so Jill, I'll try to be briefer than that.
Not sure this is that brief, but I'll try to be quick. Probably by posing this question, I'll answer it. You know, I meditate, and sometimes I have a calm mind, and sometimes I have an agitated mind. And one of the things that I'm trying to learn a skill for, and so this is a specific kind of question, is that sometimes when I sit and my mind is really agitated, later on that day or something, I'll be having a conversation with someone, and I'll be expressing something that's going on, and all of a sudden it'll dawn on me that the agitation of what was going on in my mind and what where my mind was wandering off to or whatever was not really the key. That it's really not the key, and that that there was something else that was really bothering me. And it happened just recently where I'd found out that this friend of mine has really advanced stages of cancer. And yet when I sat on my cushion, I was agitated about this really stupid stuff. And later on, it suddenly hit me that was really what was going on, that was kind of keeping me off center. Yeah. So when I'm sitting there and I have that agitated mind and I'm on a cushion, you know, what's a skillful means of getting at, you know, getting rid of that stuff that's just kind of coming up and distracting me, and figuring out or being present with what really is there that I should be sitting with?
Great question. Probably in different kind of circumstances like that, different responses are appropriate. But one I'll give today is that, you know, in some sense, so much of what goes on in our inner life is connected. There's all these tentacles, interconnectedness going on there. So even though on the surface it seems that this, this concern you had no connection to what you're really feeling, or was really going on deep inside while you were agitated. You were thinking about what to make for dinner, maybe, you know, but really you're upset about your friend. Still, there's a connection. And one way to find the connection is if you bring your attention carefully to thinking about dinner menus, that, you know, whatever it might be, and see what's going on here. What's going on with dinner menu? What's kind of look around the edges of it. What's the full picture of, you know, what's emotionally what's going on? What's going on in my body? You'll probably very quickly discover that underneath dinner menu, there's a level of anxiety, perhaps. And so then, okay, let me connect to the anxiety. And as you connect to the anxiety might open up to this issue around your friend. So there's a way of, whatever's going on, there's a way of connecting to it and opening up and seeing all the different aspects of it. And as you open up to different aspects of it, the full ecology of it, you'll find what part of the ecology is the one that will take you deeper into what you're experiencing, what's happening. But if you try to get rid of the superficial thinking too quickly, you're doing yourself a disservice. You know, you also have kind of aversion there and some judgment. But rather than having aversion for something, if you study it and study the full ecology of that thinking, then you'll discover, you'll naturally, I think, find your way down. And it's kind of like a principle, which I don't know if I want to kind of make an absolute statement, but it's kind of like a principle I believe that everything will lead you to the depths. You know, everything has its roots in our depths of our being, so that no matter how superficial it might seem, if there's a way of connecting to it, it'll lead you to the depths. And if it's leading you to the depths, you'll encounter these kinds of issues like your friend on the way. Does it address your concern?
It does.
So, thank you very much.